It's our great pleasure to have Andrea Giusti as our speaker. Andrea is a Marie Curie Fellow at ETH Zurich, and today he will tell us about a coherent state description of black holes and the late goodness. So, Andrea, you can now start on your level.
Right on. Okay, first of all, let me thank Alessia for the kind invitation and you all for having me today. With this presentation, I would like to introduce you to a very simple idea, namely trying to understand classical spacetimes as the result of coherent state of gravitons. I hear a weird sound in my earpiece, so maybe we should try to mute some participants.
No, I mean, I will just mute my microphone.
Okay. Never mind then. So the key idea is to try to reconstruct classical space-time as a result of a coherent state of gravitons. And we basically they take a large amount of inspiration from the corpuscular theory of gravity, which is nothing but that the implementation of the classicalization conjecture to Einstein gravity, which basically means that we can understand black holes and more general also the De Sitter space as a result of a self-sustained marginally bound state of a large number n of soft and off-shell gravitons, which even some simple assumption ultimately leads to three very well-known scaling laws, namely that the number of constituents of this coherent state scales according to the squared ADM mass over the Planck mass, which basically means that the number of the constituent of this coherent state is a sort of measure of the entropy of the classical black hole configuration, that the typical momentum of the constituents of these black holes, of this marginally bound state, is scales like one over the classical sides of the gravitational radius, which basically means that the typical or average wavelength associated to the constituents of this state scales like the size of the black hole itself. And lastly, that the effective non-dimensional self-coupling of the gravitons within this bound state scales like one over the number of the constituents of this system, which basically means that once the black hole is formed, the effective interaction within this bound state, between the constituents of this bound state, is extremely weak. But if we now try to look at these systems as from the perspective of condensed matter physics, we can immediately identify alpha times n as the collective coupling of the system, which basically is of order one for this kind of configuration, which basically means that our system is basically in the strong coupling regime. But now if we combine this condition with the fact that the effective coupling within the bound state is extremely weak, this basically tells us that the system is stuck at the critical point, and therefore it cannot really hold on to all of its constituent, but rather it will be subjected to a strong quantum depletion effect. And you can actually estimate the contribution of this quantum depletion effect by looking at the leading order contribution within this bound state. And in particular, if we look at the scattering within of two gravitons within this marginally bound state, which is supposed to be the leading contribution to this depletion effect, we actually can compute the master equation for this depletion effect, which to the leading order reduces to this master equation. But now if we recall the relationship between the number of the constituents of this marginally bound state and the ADM mass of the system, we immediately find that this master equation is nothing but the master equation for the Hawking radiation, which basically means that in corpuscular gravity, Hawking radiation is nothing but the result of the graviton depletion out of this marginally bound state, and that the thermality of the standard Hawking radiation is recovered as a result of the softness of the constituents, since they scale, the momentum of these constituents scale like one over the classical size of the horizon, and plus combinatorics. Furthermore, since we don't see any black hole popping out of black holes popping out of the vacuum. We have that some sort of matter had to collapse to form, to actually source the formation of this sort of marginally bound states. And we can actually estimate the effect of the depletion, as of the quantum depletion, onto the matter component of our black holes, which are more properly understood as self-sustained marginally bound state of gravitons and matter. And to the leading order, we actually find that the master equation for this depletion of baryonic matter is actually 1/n suppressed compared to the one of the gravitons. So basically, matter can escape, but this contribution is extremely suppressed compared to the graviton depletion. And still, but still, this gives us a sort of 1/n quantum error effect in this corpuscular description of black holes. So now, if let me just summarize the main assumption and objectives of our approach. The idea is to look at the case of static and spherically symmetric spacetimes with this additional condition that basically tell us that we don't have any sort of anomalous redshift effect. And therefore, we basically have that our typical line element can be written in this form, where V here is just our classical potential. And now if we look at the Einstein-Hilbert action coupled to matter, and we linearize it for a static source with no relativistic speeds, we immediately find that the effective Lagrangian that we get from this linearization looks pretty much like a massless scalar field V, which is also static. So,
Is a question.
Okay, go ahead. By the way, I keep hearing this annoying sound in my ears.
Go ahead. Last slide, please.
Sorry, what?
Can you go back to the last previous slide, please?
Yeah, sure. Okay,
this one. I didn't quite get where you put that constraint that you wanted GTT multiplied by GRR equal to -1. Because, you know, if you want to have like a general static spherically symmetric metric, it could be like anything. Why we're having that constraint on that metric?
Because we just want GRR and GTT to be equal. It should be equal to one over the other, basically. So we simply want something which is as simple as possible.
So just in case of simplicity, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just for that. Exactly.
But it's not like the most general static spherical symmetry.
Absolutely not. That's right. Yeah. This is an additional constraint that we put onto this this condition, onto our assumptions.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay, then, so the key idea is to consider a simple effective Lagrangian for a massless real scalar field and treat this scalar field not as a fundamental degrees of freedom, but just as a convenient way of representing the non-perturbative physics of a compact source, and then quantize this linear theory and construct the coherent state G, a coherent state G such that the expectation value of the scalar field pi onto this coherent state simply yields our classical geometry, our classical potential, at least in the regions which are accessible to our experiments. Therefore, this potential, this scalar field phi, which is canonically normalized, is nothing but a mean field potential for our theory. So let me try to briefly characterize the quantum coherent state for a given classical configuration within our set of assumptions. And the first thing we have to do for that is to characterize the quantum vacuum that naively is understood within our approach as a system which is devoid of any sort of matter or gravitational excitations. And now, given a certain static potential, classical static potential V of R, we shall try to construct this coherent state for our massless scalar field. And to do that, we start off from the D'Alembert equation on Minkowski space, and we look for our normal modes solution for this equation, which are easily written in terms of the spherical Bessel function of order zero. And then we can simply expand the scalar field phi and the corresponding momentum in terms of the normal modes. and then setting the canonical commutation relation, we derive the standard commutation relations for our creation and annihilation operators. This is pretty much standard stuff. So after that, we can simply characterize our vacuum as a state which is annihilated by the annihilation operator AK, while the Fock space is again built onto the vacuum in the standard way. And what we now shall try to look for is a quantum state that looks as classical as possible. So that gives us a potential, a mean field potential that looks the closest to our classical potential. And the natural choice for something like that is actually a coherent state, which in general can be written in this form, where these GKs are simply the occupation number as a function, the occupation numbers as a function of the momenta. And the only requirement that we put on this coherent state is that the expectation value of this scalar field onto this coherent state simply gives us something close to our classical potential. But now, if we can explicitly expand this expectation values using this definition for our coherent state, which ultimately yields this convoluted expression here. But yet again, if we assume staticity, we can simply drop this term by setting jk, gamma k equal to kt. Additionally, if we rewrite our classical potential in terms of its Fourier expansion, we can plug these two expressions here into our defining equation for our coherent state. And this ultimately yield a relationship between our occupation numbers as a function of the momenta in terms of the Fourier transform of the classical potential. And therefore now the coherent state for such a configuration is simply given, can be constructed out of the vacuum through these simple operators, and Ng, which is known as the number of constituents of this coherent state, represents simply our normalization factor for our state. And it is simply given by this expression here. But then, okay, this is the general way of approaching the problem. Let's look at what happens if we focus on the case of a Schwarzschild black hole, for instance. Namely, we take this line element, and the classical potential is simply the Newtonian potential, whereas RH is our Schwarzschild radius. Now, we can take the Fourier transform of the Newtonian potential, which is simply given here, which allows us to find the form of our occupation numbers, which are again easily found like this. And now we can try to compute the number of constituents of this coherent state, which turns out to be logarithmically divergent in both the infrared and the ultraviolet, which technically means that there is no such, we cannot have a coherent state that reproduces the classical potential on the entire space time, on the entire manifold. But this is something that we actually expect somehow. In fact, the UV divergence comes from the fact that we have that the size of our source vanishes since everything collapsed to the singularity. And therefore we can provide a regularization for the UV divergence by simply requiring that the system has a regular quantum matter core of finite size, which will serve as our UV cutoff. Similarly, the infrared divergence comes from the fact that the Schwarzschild black hole is an eternal black hole, and this is rather unphysical. And the regularization of such a divergence can come simply by assuming a finite lifetime for the system, which serves as an infrared cutoff for the theory. So if we impose these two cutoffs in the computation for the occupation number, for the total occupation number, we recover the corpuscular scaling law for the number of the constituents of this coherent state. Then we can wonder what happens to the typical momentum of the constituents of these coherent states. And we can actually compute it by averaging over the momentum of the system, of the constituents of the system. And what we find is that the result for this expectation value of the momenta scales like 1 over the size of the UV cutoff, rather than the size of the classical horizon of our black hole. And therefore, we have to look a little bit more carefully into this UV cutoff. And to do that, we decided to use a simple example, which is basically the case of the spherical collapse of a ball of dust of area radius R and proper time tau. And this spherical collapse is simply governed by the equation for radial null geodesics in the Schwarzschild spacetime, which is simply given here up to order one multiplicative factors. And then looking at this equation, we can simply write down an effective Hamiltonian for the problem, which is simply given here. And we can proceed with a simple quantization of this problem by simply replacing the radius with a radius operator, the momentum with the corresponding momentum operator, and both of these operators acting on an Hilbert space, which is just the space of square integral function on R3. Now, this problem simply reduces to the eigenvalue problem for this Hamiltonian, which can be easily solved and basically yields a discrete spectrum for these epsilon n coefficients, which are nothing but this quantity right here. And n is simply our quantum number, which is supposed to be an integer larger than one. And the corresponding wave functions for this eigenvalue problem are simply given by generalized Laguerre polynomials. And the additional condition that this quantity, so e squared over m squared, is supposed to be positive, sets an additional constraint on this occupation, or this quantum number n. Specifically, n should be larger than a certain n star value, which scales exactly like the number of constituents of the coherent state of our system. So basically, we have a connection between the number of constituents of our system and the minimum quantum number allowed for this simple quantization, which basically sets also the minimum size for our ground state, which can be used as our UV regulator in our computation for the expectation value of the typical momentum of the constituents of our coherent state. To be more precise, if we carry out the precise computation in this spherical collapse, the value of this UV cutoff is slightly smaller, or in general smaller, than the classical size of the horizon. And what we find is that generally the typical momentum associated to these constituents of the coherent state will scale therefore like one over the typical size of the classical radius of the horizon. And therefore we have been able to reproduce the corpuscular scaling laws also for the typical momentum of the constituents by using some very simple arguments. Then the natural question is what can we do now with this simple characterization of the coherent state? Then the first thing we can do is try to reconstruct a geometry for a collapsed object and try to understand how the cutoff affect the quantum improved geometry. The only requirement that we make is that the quantum improved potential, which is a result of this coherent state, should be close to the classical potential outside the classical horizon, namely in the region where we can actually perform experiments in order to be consistent with classical experiments. So now let's look at the quantum improvement of Schwarzschild geometry. And to do that, we can simply get a quantum potential out of the classical one by inverting the Fourier transform of our classical potential and constraining the value of the momenta between the infrared and UV cutoffs. And this ultimately yields this simple potential, which is simply given by the Newtonian potential times a sine integral function, which adds oscillations on top of our classical potential. So what we get if we see a plot of this potential is simply, if we consider the dashed line as the classical Newtonian potential, we see that the continuous line representing our quantum potential oscillates around the classical potential in the outer region of our system, whereas inside it has a finite limit as we approach the origin. And this might have some implication for the singularity problem, as we will see later on in this presentation. Furthermore, if we look at the fluctuations around the classical potential due to this quantum correction, what we find is that as we move away from our system, these fluctuations are extremely suppressed. Whereas if we take the limit for the cutoff to go to zero, namely if we recover the singular behavior of our spacetime, then our oscillation are switched off and we recover the standard Newtonian potential. Okay, so now we have our quantum potential. We can simply plug it into the line element in the place of the Newtonian potential and see what happens to our quantum corrected matrix. And it turns out that the first thing that we can look at is the location of the horizons, which is still a root of this equation, which turns out to be extremely close to the Schwarzschild one, to the Schwarzschild result. Furthermore, given this improved metric, we can compute the Kretschmann scalar, for instance, and we can immediately see that as we approach r equal to zero, this quantity scales like 1/r^4, which has a much weaker singularity than the standard Schwarzschild result, which goes like 1/r^6. Furthermore, if we look at the tidal forces, namely, we compute the relative acceleration of radial geodesics with the
Andrea, we could not hear you. I'm not sure how is it on Zoom, if there's a problem here or not. Andrea, are you there? We could not hear you for a couple of minutes.
For a couple of minutes? Damn.
No, I mean, maybe not a couple of minutes, but a couple of seconds. So maybe
You
can. So when you started describing the tidal forces.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay, so basically,
bad again. also on Zoom.
Namely, we compute the relative acceleration of radial geodesics. Sorry. Hello?
Yeah, so your connection at the moment is not great, and it seems like it is the same for people on Zoom. So probably it's the connection, the internet connection where you are. But
yeah, I'm afraid so.
But now it seems to be good. So maybe
stable.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Let's see how it goes.
Yeah, maybe the connection doesn't like tidal forces. Never mind then. Tidal forces turn out to be finite as we approach the center, as the r equal to zero position, which basically means that we have no spaghettification effects. So if we combine these two results, we basically have that r equal to zero turns out to be an integrable singularity, which means that nothing weird happens as we approach r equal to zero. So now we have found our results for this Schwarzschild case. What happens if we move on to a more general spacetime, namely the one for a charged black hole like Reisner-Nordström? And in particular, we simply have to consider this line element where the potential here is simply an improvement of the Schwarzschild one, which includes also an additional term involving the charge. And this situation is much richer from the classical perspective, since it splits into three configurations, namely the case where we have two horizons, an inner and an outer one. The inner one turns out to be a Cauchy horizon, which entails some problems from the perspective of the mass inflation effect and the loss of predictability. Secondly, the case of an extremal black hole where the two horizons merge together. And lastly, the case of a naked singularity. And it's therefore natural to ask whether our coherent state approach can alleviate or solve, at least in part, some of the problem associated to the Cauchy horizon and the typical singularities that emerge in this kind of classical spaces. Okay, so let's build again our coherent state for the Reisner-Nordström potential. And to do that, we can simply take the Fourier transform of the potential associated to this configuration, which is simply given by this expression, and then again compute the corresponding occupation numbers for different values of the momenta. Again, we can construct the coherent state in the standard way out of the vacuum, and NG which is the number of constituents of this coherent state, splits into three contributions, namely one which is simply the one for the Schwarzschild case, a piece which only depends on the charge of the system, and the third one which keeps which mixes the two terms. If we now also compute the typical momentum of the constituents of this coherent state, again, this problem splits into three components, which ultimately, if we make the assumption, the reasonable assumption that the UV cutoff is much smaller than the infrared one lengthwise, then we immediately get an expression, a simple expression for the total occupation number and for the typical momentum of the constituents of the system. And again, if we take the Schwarzschild radius to be much larger than the quantity, this quantity associated to the charge of the black hole, then we can simply compute the typical wavelength of the constituent gravitons building our geometry, which are simply given by this expression right here, which is a small correction compared to the one that we found in the Schwarzschild case. Now, if we look more closely at the corresponding quantum potential for the Reisner-Nostrum space, we immediately find that if we invert the Fourier transform of the classical potential using these infrared and UV cutoffs, we immediately find again the quantum correct potential for the Schwarzschild case, plus some additional piece which keeps track of fluctuations around the additional piece that we get in the Reisner-Nordström classical space. And if we now look at some examples, for instance, we immediately see that for the quantum corrected potential here, at least in these examples, we have that while the classical solution has two horizons, the quantum improved potential has only one horizon. So basically we lose the inner horizon for certain configurations of our UV cutoff. And furthermore, we also lose the divergence in the origins, which again will entail a sort of weakening of the singularity problems that we have in classical gravity. So if we look at the singularity problem, we immediately can compute the Kretschmann scalar for this quantum improved spacetime, and we immediately see that it scales again like 1 over r to the fourth as we approach r equal to 0, as opposed to 1 over r to the eighth in the Reisner-Nordström case. And again, tidal forces become finite as we approach the origin in this simple scenario, which basically means again that we have an integral singularity and nothing weird happens as we approach the center of our system. And we can also further characterize the properties of this integral singularities by looking at the effective stress energy tensor for this quantum corrected space-time, which ultimately is given by these expressions for the effective density, effective pressure, and the various effective pressures, which entail the emergence of trace anomaly, which is something we expect whenever we correct our classical spacetime with quantum corrections. And if we look at the volume integral of these quantities near the horizon, near the center, we immediately see that all of these quantities are finite, which is actually the defining property of an integral singularity. Okay, so moving on to, again, the problem of Cauchy and event horizons, we have that basically this equation that should determine the location of the horizon cannot be solved analytically, but can only be studied qualitatively from a numerical perspective. And in particular, what we found from our analysis is that this sort of spacetime don't have a Cauchy horizon, provided that the UV cutoff is between the two classical values of the inner and outer horizon for a certain configuration of the classical Reisner-Nordström case. So basically, if RS is between these two values, which is something which is kind of consistent, can be actually derived from an improved version of the example concerning the collapsing dust, we actually find that there is no Cauchy horizons, and therefore this kind of approach, this coherent state approach, can somehow alleviate this problem coming from the emergence of Cauchy horizons in the Reisner-Norsom spacetime. So what if we now try to apply these sort of arguments in order to describe our late universe? Namely, what if we describe our late universe as by using the simple toy model, namely Schwarzschild de Sitter geometry? Well, it turns out that we simply have to consider this line element with this simple potential, where lambda is our cosmological constant, m is our Meissner-Sharp Hernandez mass for a localized matter source of size r, and now we will denote by rh the gravitational radius of the source, and l and by L the cosmological horizon associated to our system. And if we make this simple assumption, we immediately see that RH is basically the Schwarzschild radius and for our localized source, whereas L is just the De Sitter horizon. So let's try now to characterize the coherent state which is supposed to be responsible for our Schwarzschild De Sitter configuration. And it is actually easy to see that what we want to do is construct this coherent state such that our expectation value of the scalar field reproduces our classical potential, at least in the region where our spacetime is static. And now, since we have that the typical size of our UV cutoff is smaller or of the order of the classical Schwarzschild radius, which is smaller by of the size of our typical galaxy, which is in turn much smaller than the cosmological horizon, we can approximately take the UV cutoff to be exactly the Schwarzschild radius and the infrared cutoff to be the cosmological horizon without losing of generality in our treatment. So given all these assumptions, we simply find that the total occupation number for our coherent state, given these two cutoffs, is split into three contributions, namely two holographic contributions that scale with the area of the would-be horizon of the black hole corresponding to the localized source, and the second one, which scales with the size of the horizon of the corresponding De Sitter configuration. And the last term instead kind of keeps into account an interaction between these two holographic scaling. And this is actually particularly nice since something like that comes up in a very particular scenario. Namely, if we consider...
Andrea?
Yeah?
Can you clarify in what sense those contributions are holographic?
Are holographic because they basically scale, this quantity basically measures the entropy associated to a certain space-time configuration, and they scale with the area of the corresponding horizon.
Okay,
That's what I mean by this holographic.
Okay,
and therefore, nice. And we have this additional piece that basically keeps track of the interaction between the two holographic scaling. Okay, so this particular piece is actually something that comes up in an interesting configuration, namely, if we take as a classical potential, this sort of logarithmic potential, which are supposed to be an effective model for the potential responsible for the flattening of galaxy rotation curves in Milgram's modified Newtonian dynamics, where L is a typical scale at which this sort of effect should come into play, we can actually see that if we try to build a coherent state which is responsible to reproduce this kind of classical potential, this coherent state would have a total number of constituents, which is exactly the one that we saw from the interaction between the two holographic scaling for the Schwarzschild De Sitter configuration. Namely, we started off with just a coherent state for the Schwarzschild De Sitter configuration, and we ended up with a quantum state that also contains some contributions that would resemble some Mond-like effect at intermediate scales. And this is actually kind of consistent with corpuscular gravity, since from some very simple energy balance arguments, we were actually able to derive this kind of effects by looking at the competition between the De Sitter scaling and the local Newtonian physics, which ultimately gives rise to this sort of intermediate scale forces that will then be responsible for the flattening of galaxy rotation curves. So the fact that our total occupation number for the Schwarzschild Besitter configuration also contains this additional piece is a kind of consistency check for our analysis. So lastly, I would like to comment on a very hot topic, which is the H0 tension that we have observed in cosmology. And the idea is actually pretty simple. We typically describe the early universe as a quasi-de Sitter configuration that within the corpuscular model can be understood as basically an empty ball of gravitons, which are marginally bound, and of typical size L bar, where L bar is the cosmological, is the quasi-de Sitter horizon. And on top of which we basically place some localized baryonic matter that in the late universe can be simply modeled within this approach as a Schwarzschild Sitter configuration, where the occupation number for the total occupation number for this coherent state simply scales like as we have seen in the previous slide. So if we now assume the conservation of the number of the constituents, we can actually find a relationship between the early universe quasi-de Sitter horizon and the late universe one. And now the idea is to think of this L bar quantity, namely the early universe one, as something which is related to the measure associated to the CMB experiments, whereas we should interpret type 1a supernova experiments as results that basically relate to or carry some information about the late universe sides of the cosmological horizon. But now if we sprinkle on top of our system a large number of identical galaxies for the sake of simplicity, and we assume that we have a 5% of baryonic content in our universe, what we find is that the difference between the value of the H0 coming from the supernova type 1a experiment and the one of the CMB differ by a 5% by a 5% margin, which is strikingly close to what we observed, which is about 7 or 8% difference from our experiments. So to sum up, the starting point of our analysis was an analogy with the corpuscular scaling laws, and what we wanted to do is to provide a coherent state representation for static and spherically symmetric spacetimes by using as our starting point a quantum massless real scalar field, which is treated as a sort of mean field potential and not a fundamental degree of freedom of the theory. Then we basically applied this general setup to the case of Schwarzschild, Reisner-Nordström, and Reisner-Nordström black holes, and the case of the Schwarzschild de Sitter geometry. And this analysis basically allows us to reproduce the corpuscular scaling for all of our scenarios. And for the case of black holes, it also provides a natural way of a resolution of the singularity, which in this context become integral singularities. And it also allows us to remove the problem of Cauchy horizon for the Reisner-Nordström case. Lastly, if we apply these arguments to the Schwarzschild de Sitter case, the coherent states that reproduces this classical potential is basically picks up for free an additional contribution that reproduces as Hammond-like potential. And if we extend these arguments to the H0 tension, we find that somehow these simple arguments seem to be able to relax the observed tension, or at least to justify it a bit. Even though I wouldn't say that this is a proper justification of this kind of tension, since after all this is a very simplified model and based on some very end wavy computation at this point. So this is pretty much it, and I must thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Andrea, for the very nice talk.
And I apologize for the problem due to the connection.
No problem, seems to be resolved. So are there questions first from students? Jaime?
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
It's more of a curiosity, but because you're essentially obtaining an effective geometry that looks like a Schwarzschild but has some kind of oscillation pattern where the scale of the oscillations is related to the scale of the horizon, mm-hmm. if I understood that correctly.
Yeah.
You had a look at how does that change the spectrum of quasi-normal modes of the space-time? Because these kind of oscillations can be very, like, can modify the spectrum very much. So you maybe could be able to put constraints on these kind of geometries.
It turns out that this is something that I had in the back of my mind. And a few simple arguments showed that the correction to quasi-normal modes is almost negligible. So you don't get huge deviation from the standard classical results. I mean,
could you explain why? Because like there are these recent arguments that even if like you go very far away on the potential and you put a small bump, even if the bump is like very, very small, you destabilize the overtones completely.
Mm-hmm.
So like that's why I'm saying that. I don't know. Like, could you explain why, what are these kind of arguments that you say?
I wouldn't go too much into details because they are not published yet. So I'd rather keep it for a different time.
Okay, that's all right. Thank you.
Other questions? In particular from students, please. Leighton.
Yes. Could I just ask, I thought it was interesting, this idea that you get the 5% discrepancy between the two Hubbles from the fact that the baryon density is about 5% today.
Yeah.
And so then that fraction is, of course, changes in time. So it'll be a lot less than 5% in the future, and it was a lot more than 5% in the past. Is the prediction, would you similarly think based on that reasoning that the Hubble discrepancy was a lot bigger in the past and will go away in the future? Is that,
I mean,
or is there something maybe special about the present time because we're just transitioning to?
The problem is that it's extremely hard to say because here we are just doing some order of magnitude analysis, which basically cut away any sort of multiplicative order one multiplicative factor. So whatever we can say, it's kind of shaky at this point, unless we perform a precise analysis of the situation.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Laurent?
Hello.
Hi there.
Very nice talk, Andreas. Something that grabbed my attention because it connects to some other idea by Colombretti is this idea that somehow the cutoff is related to the number of constituents.
Mm-hmm.
And you went a bit fast about that, but I'm sure you have a deeper understanding or story behind this connection. What is your understanding of that?
I mean,
and how generic that would be, let's say. If I want to take a lesson out of this, you know, simplified model, is that something?
I mean, the connection between the size of the cutoff and the size of the horizon and the number of the constituents comes from this very simple spherical collapse model. So it's just a result of that I took as a reference for setting the sides of the ground state of the system.
But would you have a deeper, like, would you say there's something generic about it or some lessons to be learned? That's, I know this is the result of a calculation, but do you have an a priori understanding?
I don't have it yet, to be honest, because first one should look at more carefully at the gravitational collapse in general and see whether one can reproduce something like that also in a more generous configuration, right?
Yeah. Well, in fact, that was my second question. So how much here you're spherically symmetric and, I mean, sometimes it could be misleading. There's a lot of things that comes from having the higher multiple moments, et cetera. So how much, I'm sure you have thought about the generalization. Is there a way to?
Yeah, we are actually working on an extension beyond static and spherically symmetric spaces, though the complications are pretty hard to handle. Yeah.
Have you thought about doing some kind of multipolar expansion?
I thought about that, but I still honestly don't know how to truly implement this within this approach.
Okay.
Yeah, as I said, this is a very simplified model for something which is in principle extremely complicated also because our scalar field is just a mean field description that we assume to behave in a certain way.
So that was my question. To what extent can you, you have stability of some of these arguments?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe a last question is, you know, I think there's been a lot of work in quantum gravity on different effective model inside of horizons, etc. Do you, you know, what's the landscape? How do you connect with some of these models? And
I mean, I kind of see some similarities with Carlo's Planck's stars model, because after all, even in that context, you have a sort of finite size core, which is supposed to be fully quantum, and that somehow should behave like this, even though in that model, if I remember it correctly, the size of the quantum region is much smaller than the one that we actually have here.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about some Hamiltonian, you know, model too.
I haven't really thought about that, to be honest.
Okay, maybe there are more special.
Because the landscape is huge, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Other questions? I would also ask a couple of questions if there is no one else. Well, first, maybe in the direction of Laurent's question, you have also worked with Gia and I mean, on corpuscular gravity, and some of your assumptions are inspired from corpuscular gravity. So what would be, in your opinion, the connection between, a potential connection between corpuscular gravity and something like Planck's star that you mentioned? You think it is very similar to that context?
I mean, the effect is what I meant is that the effective geometry that we get from this simple regularization of the potential looks like something similar to an effective Planck star. This is just the only thing that I mean by that. So I don't see whether there is a true connection between Planck stars and Gia's model in general.
Okay.
Just analytically speaking, there is a similarity.
Another question is in your computations, did you use anything specific in terms of dynamics? So did you use Einstein equations or at any point or not?
Not at all.
Okay, so you don't make assumptions about the dynamics?
Not at all, exactly.
Okay. So this is an important point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead. If you want to comment more on that.
No, exactly. This is an important point to point out, yeah.
Okay. So if there are no other questions, I would still ask some other questions. So so at the beginning, when you were trying to build this coherent state, starting from the classical potential, you say that the fact that you arrive at that integral that diverges with a standard zero infinity limits, the only reason why you get a result that is divergent is that practically that means that you cannot build a coherent state out of that classical potential. But do you think that
for the full space time,
do you think that you could do that if you would start from a potential that is, a modified potential that is, for instance, regular in the center, and then you would not have this type of divergences, and then you would be able to go ahead with your quantization without introducing the UV and the infrared cutoffs?
Absolutely, I don't see why not.
Okay.
Yeah, if you start off with something regular, you shouldn't get anything odd from it, from this coherent state approach.
Okay, so in a sense, you could set up an iteration in the sense that you start from something that is singular, then you proceed with your
regularization,
get, with using this type of cutoffs, then get quantum potential, and then use that as a starting point to construct a new coherent state and hope for convergence.
Well, won't you still get the infrared divergences? This is a classical divergence for
exactly
masses. So this one will not go away.
Yeah,
exactly. That one will not go away, but you still have to regularize it in some way. Yeah. Yeah, I thought she was just referring to the UV part.
And so you think the feature of the oscillations that comes, so in this model, it comes essentially from the fact that you have UV and infrared cutoffs, but would you expect that to be stable in general?
Yeah, I don't actually see why not, to be honest. Wait a second, because actually our oscillation comes just from the infrared, the UV part. So if you don't have a UV regularization, I don't really expect that any sort of oscillation might come up in the regularized potential.
Is there a question on the chat?
Yet again,
it is probably just a comment by Roberto.
As Roberto points out, the sharp cutoff is just an approximation. If you want to be more precise, you should use some regularizing function to smooth out the behavior above the threshold, the cutoff, and below the cutoff. Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. Other questions on Zoom or here? Then let me ask one last question. Just because I was interested in which conditions did you use to know that what you get is an integrable singularity, because that I remember, so there were like three conditions to determine whether a singularity is integrable or not, but I see only one there.
We have three: the fact that our tidal forces are finite, and the fact that the integration of our effective stress energy tensor yields something finite around the location of the singularity.
Okay, I missed that. I thought that your conclusion came only from the tidal forces.
No.
The limit goes to zero. Okay, perfect. Then.
Yeah, I didn't want to repeat the same computation for both Schwarzschild and the Reisner-Nordström, so I just analyzed this Reisner-Nordström effective stress-energy tensor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Makes sense. Thank you for the clarification.
No, thank you.
So if there are no other questions, so you have 2 minutes for asking more questions if there is any. But I don't see any other questions, so let's thank again Andrea for the nice talk and the nice discussion.
Thank you very much for having me.